Like a trusted turnout jacket you've had for years, Flex 7 outer shell fabric delivers a perfectly broken-in feel on the very first wear. Flexible, comfortable, and powered with the strength of Enforce technology, Flex 7 outer shell fabric is made to move. To learn more, visit tenkatafabrics.com/flex7. Flex 7, powered by Enforce technology, only from Tenkata Protective Fabrics.
Breathing in diesel exhaust fumes is like walking into a fire without a mask. Over time, those toxins lead to cancer. Protect yourself with MagnaGrip, the easiest, most reliable exhaust removal system that features a true 100% seal to eliminate diesel exhaust fumes. To get free grant assistance, visit MagnaGrip.com.
Everybody up on this roof, that they're all off the roof. I am on the roof of Exposure 4. That's fire through the roof of the fire building the entire rear section.
Now, remember, given the payday, as if it accounted for, okay?
610B, that was the payday, 610B.
I'm here, we got a fire. 1.5-story, single family dwelling, fire shown from the second floor. Give me a second alarm on this.
Bring up to the top floor, I got people hanging out the top floor windows with a baby.
Commercial building, a lot of fire, a lot of smoke. Go ahead and strike a third alarm on my orders on this.
I got people on the front fire escape here with windows rented below them. We need somebody up there.
Yeah, let them know we got a job. I'm pulling up now. Second alarm, I got a 1-story single family frame, heavy fire showing from the attic.
So we're using all heaters. We got one line stretch, fire on the fourth floor, second line being stretched. Primary searches are underway.
Hey, welcome back to our fire engineering podcast, The Command Post. I'm Chief Rick Lasky, along with my best buddy, Chief John Salka. And we've got another great topic, as we always do. We chose right before we went live for the topic we're talking about today. I think you'll enjoy it. Just a quick reminder, John and I and Chief Scott Thompson, we have the third Hump Day Hangout of the month right here at FireEngineering.com. So the third Wednesday at noon Central Time. Chief Terry McGrath, our longtime partner, changed careers and retired from the Louisville Fire Department. Has got a great new job where he's at right now, and he's having to adjust his time commitment. So Terry will take a little vacation from us for right now, but we'll get him back on as soon as we can. We love Terry. And last show, John, we had my ops chief, my ops/training ops chief here at Estes Valley Fire, Chief Paul Capo, on as our guest. And then after we went live, after we went off, you, me, and Scott threw the hook at him and drug him over to our side. And he's going to be a regular host, a regular guest, regular
great,
part of our
great,
team.
Great. Looking forward to having him.
Yeah, on our Hump Day Hangout. So if you can join us for our next show, it'll be on Ground Ladders, and we'll actually have another special guest with us for that show. So see if you can join us there. Now, John, I'm looking at you. I'm looking in the background. You've got to be in Myrtle Beach. You've got to be in one of your favorite places on the face of the earth, besides the Poconos and then back home. But you and the family are down in Myrtle Beach, right?
We are. We're in Myrtle Beach for a couple of weeks. We're having a great time. Some of the kids have been here. James and Adriana and James Jr. were here. Brian, Rachel, and the two girls, Layla and Alaska, they were here for a while. And Johnny and Sarah and the two boys are coming, Finn and the youngest. So we're going to have all the boys here, my three sons, each with their wives and kids at one point or another. So we're having a great time.
Yeah, I think there was a show once called My Three Sons. Kind of different. We could do the – I just thought a reality show called the Salka Clan or the Salka Compound would work, which is – everything that goes on at your house with that family and grandkids and kids and stuff and everything else. But and a little message for our viewers, our listeners, check out the June issue Fire Engineering Magazine. Zip over to the Volunteers Corner. I've got an article in there called The Human Factor, and that's what it takes today, commitment wise, training wise, everything wise, to be a volunteer firefighter. And I hope you enjoy. Take a read. Let me know what you think when you see it. But John, one of the topics, you know, we've talked about in the past on several shows, we've been doing, golly, between Old School, the Command Post, and Hump Day Hangouts, we've been doing like for years and years and years. But one of the topics that comes up when you and I are on the phone and then we talk to other people in classes is, and I think you refer to it as the first arriving sequence of events for the first arriving company or companies. Do we want to talk strictly private dwellings, and commercial, or what do you want to talk about this first arriving sequence of events for the company?
I mean, I think if we stay with private dwellings, as far as the conversation for our purposes today, I think if we stay with private dwellings, it'll just simplify it a little bit. But I must say that, and you know, and probably our listeners know as well, it's not dramatically different other than, you know, if you get the high-rise buildings or unique, you know, one-of-a-kind things. But whether you're talking about a private dwelling or a multiple dwelling or an apartment house, a lot of the sequence sort of rules, I hate to call them rules, but a lot of the sequence rules or habits or traditions that we do are very similar. There's some priorities that just almost always call for certain things to be done first and other things to be, you know, maybe delayed slightly until those first actions get taken. So I think if we stay for the purposes of our conversation here now, today, with private dwellings or house fires, it'll just simplify it a little bit. And of course, we can always throw a couple of comments in there like, well, if you were an apartment house, you might do a little something different. But yeah, I think house fires or private dwellings for today is a great idea.
All right. Well, great. Let's start with the dispatch. All right. So, and what I always point to for our viewers or listeners is John's background. You know, 33 years, the busiest companies in the FDNY, 50 years in the fire service as a whole. Drive home from the Bronx. You're with your volunteer department. Fires are fires. Dispatch wise, let's start before we even, you know, before we even jump on the rigs. What are you looking? We're talking about first arriving sequence of events. Some of that has to be dictated, John, by what you're hearing in the dispatch on the radio, how the call comes in. What are you looking for as a captain on Engine 48 or in South Blooming Grove or a battalion chief? You respond to a private dwelling. They're dropping the tones right now. What do you want to hear coming over the radio that's going to help you begin this sequence of events for the first arriving company?
Right. Well, what's interesting is whether you're in the Bronx, whether I was a captain of 48 engine, or whether I was, you know, in a volunteer department somewhere like yourself, it's interesting. Obviously, a large fire department or even a smaller, but let's just specify career fire department, people on duty in the firehouse, right? You get a report of a house fire or fire in a private dwelling. Obviously, they're going to dispatch engines, one engine, two engines. Everybody's got different assignments, whether it be staffing, whether it be how many units are going to be assigned. But certainly every fire department in the world, when there's a fire call comes in, an engine is being dispatched, right? Now, what's interesting in the volunteers is, basically it is the same, except sometimes, now it depends on where you work. I remember years and years ago when I was in the Mineola Volunteer Fire Department out on Long Island, I was in a truck company. And I must tell you, and I thought it worked great. I'm not sure if they still do it this way or not. But when you were in truck company two, You had your red helmet. You had your gear either on that rig or in the rack behind or near that rig. Excuse me. And when a run came in, I ran in that firehouse. I drove there and ran down the block from my parking spot and ran it to the bay with the intention of getting on that tiller rig, getting on that fire truck, right? If you were in engine company one, which is the bay right next door, same building, you know, with the black helmets, those guys are running in with every intention of getting on their engine. Now, I'm not saying that happened routinely or regularly, and it was a long, long time ago now since I've been in the Mineola Fire Department, but I don't ever remember ever riding on an engine there, ever. I remember always just getting on that truck. Now, I was a young man at the time, and I was young in the fire service, so I'm sure they didn't want to send me over. Even if they were light, they would probably send a guy with a little bit more time than me. But there could have been times where a truck pulled out ahead of the engine, you know, because maybe the truck got a full crew before the engine did, and the truck could roll out and head down there. We're talking about a tiller rig with a 2.5 gallon extinguisher. No pump, no water, no tank, no nothing. So, but the point is, if you have a fire, personally, I think you're out of your mind if you don't get an engine on the road first. First and foremost, get an engine on the road. And that's how we do it in South Blooming Grove, the volunteer department that I'm a member of right now. When it's a house fire or really any kind of fire, priority is engine first. And that's how we got them set up in the bay. We only have two bays, and they're doubled up. We get the first rig in the front, and we get the second rig behind it. So the first rig out the door is an engine. And, of course, that makes absolute sense when you got a report of a fire, whether it's a car fire or a house fire or an unknown type fire. Obviously, an engine is the apparatus to handle that type situation.
Well, you and I always have fun, the engine versus truck, truck versus engine. And as much as I, you know, pride myself on being a truck guy, having been a roofer and all that stuff, we've talked about this before, you can't beat a fire out with a pipe pole. And we suck without water, you know, and, you know, getting the engine there, you know, you and I have done shows on apparatus placement, you know, how that can kill an incident or help an incident, depending on where you park your rigs and what you do, letting the toolbox get to the front, but stretching hose the right way. But you're exactly right. Getting the engine out the door as safely and as quickly as you can. Career department, dump it onto the floor and off you go. Volunteer department, driving as safely but as quickly as you can to get to the station to be able to get on the rig and get out the door. Because we always talk about the three response times for the volunteers. That's from your home or business to the station. Then people always forget about, well, as soon as I get here, I have to get my turnout gear, you know, boom, 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 my gear. And then the third response is actually to the scene. But like you, and we've talked about this, you know, so engine's going out, I'm listening, you know, to the nature of the call. Let's say structure fire and structure fire, and I'm listening, okay, occupant, you know, all units en route, you know, blah, blah, blah. Occupants reporting an odor of smoke or smoke on the second floor or smoke coming from the eaves or smoke coming from the neighbor's house or actual flames or whatever. The house next door, the house I just drove by, the car's on fire next to the house, all those different, and we could go on and on with all those different things. But each one of those is going to dictate, you know, what you're going to do tactically when you get there. But that doesn't, I liked how you said that, John, it doesn't take away from the fact that the engine's got to get out the door, the engine has to pull up, do their thing. They have to prepare. You and I have hammered on this. I don't care if there's nothing showing or not. You've got to pull up and be ready to stretch hose. How many times, John, have you been to a job and there's nothing showing and the crews get in or you get in there and you got a room rolling? You know, I'm saying there was no right. smoke and like that. You know, we just had this talk recently about, you know, engines showing up and everybody disembarking. Everybody gets off and they all follow like ducks the officer into the building. And lo and behold, they get to the second floor. And they got a job. Now they got to run back outside, get the hose line, all that. Instead of you pull up, if you've got nothing showing visible from outside, you're doing your investigation, you got your nozzle person standing there ready to stretch hose. You're in there. And this discussion comes up a lot, John. Well, and you know how people can get sometimes. Well, that's not two in, two out. I go, you know, exactly, you're right. It's not two in, two out if you want to still play that road. Right. Just a great article.
Well, another thing that's real important is, you know, we talk about preparation, and I heard that saying somewhere. I forget where I heard it, but I spread it and I repeat it as many times as I can. Right? You don't have to get ready to stay ready. Right? And one of the things I talk about all the time with guys and the volunteers or at seminars or anywhere else, articles, is if you're responding to the firehouse. Obviously, you're a career fire department, and you're already on duty in the firehouse. There is absolutely no reason, and no excuse for not being fully geared up. You should have your gear on when you get on that rig going on a run. I really don't care what the run is. It's not like, oh, for fires we get dressed, but for emergencies, we wait till we get there. I don't buy that. So I think you should be fully geared up. And that's pretty easy for career guys because they're already on duty. They got their gear probably already off the rack in the vicinity of the rig, maybe right next to the door where they climb on. You know, now you get to the volunteers that are screaming down the block, coming in from home, coming in from work from somewhere, dashing down the street or coming in from the parking lot. Now they got to run over to the gear rack, grab their gear, run over to the rig. Many, many, many times right now, currently, 2024, I may be the last guy to get to the firehouse before the rig pulls out. And sometimes I got to grab my gear and jump on the rig with the gear in my hand. But I get dressed if I can on the way there. But a lot of other guys get there, the first guy, the second guy, the third guy. Again, there's no excuse for not grabbing your gear, getting quickly dressed. We're talking about bunker pants, stepping into your boots and pulling them up. We're talking about throwing a radio on and a coat, and that's it. You jump on the rig. You can put your helmet on, your gloves on. You can button up and get your SCBA all while you're responding. But you got to get dressed because that is the time, and I've said that many times. That time is not yours. You can't get to the rig and start, you know, pull up to a scene of a building on fire. A lot of times there's no report of people trapped, but occasionally it's people screaming. There's somebody in there. You can't be getting dressed in front of a building for a minute or two while people are inside waiting to be rescued. It's just not acceptable.
Exactly. I always say this, we talked about this before. So you said it, the career guys and gals, they've got their gear hanging on the rig, next to the rig, wherever off they go, they can, boom. For the volunteers, and I've done this for years, I know you have, as one of their trainings is, okay, your gear is hanging on the rack, your PP room, whatever. I've never went to a call, put my gear on in the training room, run out to the rig. I pulled into the parking lot, went inside, got to my gear rack, bunker pants on the floor, put those on, hood, radio, coat. So stand next to your locker and somebody with a stopwatch, right? We talked about this. You want to be more, efficient, proficient, quicker with donning your protective clothing. You stand there and you got your buddy with his or her stopwatch. You go, go. And you grab your pants off the shelf, off your bottom, you put them down, you put them on, you put your hood on. I always take my hood and slide it through my boots. So I had to put it on my radio, my coat, boom, off we go. And then do it over and over and over again, because like you said, they're not our seconds. So the faster I can be at putting my turnout gear on, the quicker we can get on a rig and off we go. But like you said, the point of grabbing gear and trying to get dressed when you're not supposed to be on the way to the call with seatbelts and stuff, how long? I mean, you should be proficient enough to get in your gear right now that quick. Like you said it, how hard is it to kick your shoes off, put your bunker pants on, pull a hood over your head, radio, coat, grab your helmet, off you go? It shouldn't take you that long. And there's a lot of people that have proven that through videos and everything else because of practice and training. So that being said, out the door safely, quickly, we go. Like I said, we pull up and now we either have something showing, nothing showing, fire showing, whatever, that kind of stuff. Apparatus placement's huge. We're talking the sequence of events, but like you said before, we suck without water. Now, there's times where your ladder truck may get there, obviously ahead of the engine, and they've got their sequence of events they have to begin to do, whether it's forced entry, throw a ladder going in, searching for the fire, so on and so forth. So let's talk engine stuff, John. Engine pulls up. You've got moderate. You've got decent smoke showing. Private dwelling, decent smoke showing. Talk to me about placement, and then talk to me about like line stretching and all that stuff. Let's talk about that sequence of events first before we talk truck. Engine gets there, boom, placement, and then line selection.
I love talking about this because there's so many great places out there doing things. And actually now, as you and I have talked about more recently, but not only recently, there's so much out there now on Facebook and all the other sites that people talk about. There's so many folks running training. There's so many folks running seminars. There's so many folks running stuff online, training events online, and even hands-on stuff, right? Demonstrations and stuff. So my point is, I think the typical firefighter, the typical fire company, the typical fire officer, career, paid, volunteer combination doesn't really matter to me. There's so much more information, I think, available to the typical field firefighter, the typical firefighter and company officer. There's so much information available that, you can see guys come in on a Wednesday night drill night and say, hey, Cap, you know what? Look what Billy and I saw online this week. There's some guys out west that came up with a new fold or a new stretch or a new nozzle or whatever it is. We could get into 1,000 different things. So I think that's all positive. That's resulting in a very positive, I think, sort of atmosphere. It's almost like there's a reinvention of the fire service going on to some degree. And the one thing I want to bring up specifically and particularly, and I know, and you know who I'm going to talk about, right? I talk about Wichita all the time. I was so fortunate that my son got on in Wichita, spent a short amount of time there before some other changes occurred and he ended up somewhere else, but a great, great place. And I know my son has told me a couple of times that, and I'm almost certain that this is correct, that they like punch a clock, not literally or actually, but from when the wheels stop, from when the engine company pulls up in front of a fire, in a house, and from the wheels stop and a brake goes on, they have a goal. They have a number of seconds that they are expected to pull the line and get it stretched and, flaked out and ready to go and charged. And they stand by that, and they enforce it, and they follow it, and they strive and work really hard to get that done. And I think that's an absolutely cool way of making sure we get that line in position quickly, because both you and I have seen it, and I know our listeners have seen it as well. You watch a video of a guy pulling up, and it looks like, oh, these guys are cool. Look, nobody's running. Everybody looks calm, except you realize, wow, a minute's gone by, and they don't have they don't even have the nozzle at the front door yet. You know what I'm saying? Like, some guys are overly cool and overly calm. There should be a little fire under your tail when you pull up to a fire in a private dwelling. There should be a time clock running where you're trying to beat it and you're trying to get the line selected, pulled, flaked out, charged, and bled and ready to go inside that building under a certain amount of seconds, you know? And I think when you just described how quickly we measure and try and beat the clock when we're getting dressed with turnout gear. Why shouldn't we apply that same standard to stretching a hose line? Not as fast as we can, because as fast as we can is an open door. It's an unregistered, unnumbered, unlimited amount of time. I think you should have a time. There should be a number of seconds that you should be able to get a hose line to the front door of a private dwelling. Maybe not the fourth floor of an apartment house. Maybe that's a little bit longer. But private dwelling, house fire, there should be a number of seconds from the time that rig stops in front of the building, whether you're laid in or not, or whether other stuff has to get done. There should be a bell ringing, you know?
Exactly. And there's a method. Years and years and years and years ago, John, when I heard the term minimum company standards, I'm like, ah, oh, here we go. Another rig knocker came up with this at a conference. But when I got into it as a training chief, I'm like, this is exactly what you're talking about. So young Johnny Salka gets on a fire department and says, hey, Chief Brennan, how fast am I actually supposed to stretch the line, the front cross light to a front door? I mean, is it 2 minutes, 5 minutes, 30 seconds, whatever? And instead of pretty damn quick, so you remember you and I talking about this, and if, like I said, at first I thought it was a bunch of hoo-ha, but it actually isn't. It's a cool way to determine for your training how quick you should be able to get that line off, which obviously we always say very quick. So for our listeners, minimum company standards, you could do this with anything. Let's just talk. Pre-connected cross light. I'll make that simple. So you come around the corner, your training chief standing there. All right. He or she's got a stopwatch. You pull up. The moment the parking brake goes, they start to watch. You get off. Your firefighter's got to grab the cross light, stretch it, flake it out. Once it's flaked out, call for water. You call for water. They're masking up, doing all this stuff, blah, blah, blah. Charge a line. Now they're on air, gloves, everything, like they're at the front door, ready to go. When they open the nozzle and hit the cone, you stop the watch. So you're timing them when the moment they pull up on the scene, how long it takes them to get off the rig, stretch a line, put your mask on, be on air, gloves, helmet, boom, open it, bleed it, and be off to go. Then you repack it, and that particular crew does it three times. So now all the members of South Blooming Grove, your nozzle people, they all do this. They the different crews, not every single member, but 3-3-3-3-3. Then you lop off the greatest time, you lop off like the worst time, and you come up with what is your minimum company standard. You come up with, okay, John, we did this, over two drill nights, we did this 15 different times with three different crews or four different crews. And we came up with this is our benchmark. So John is a brand new firefighter. I'm telling you, we pull up, you should be able to get off the rig, stretch that line, flake it out, call for water, mask up, open up to bleed it, be ready to go in a minute, 2 minutes. Let's just say I'm just pulling numbers out of it, 2 minutes. And little Johnny Salka, the new firefighter, goes, okay, good, now I got something to shoot for. Now in training, you're stretching a line, because there's more than just stretching something quick. I can stretch a line quick and have it all knotted up. I can have it kinked. I cannot have my I can have my face be blowing air or whatever. This goes back to what we've always said, you and I, repetition, training. Speed comes with efficiency. Efficiency comes with training. If you want to be quicker at what you're doing, you have to be good at what you're doing. And none of it happens without repetition and training. So you could do these minimum company standards, folks, with a ladder. How long does it take you to throw a ladder and make it to the roof with a saw? How long does it take you to cut a hole? How long does it take your guy to flush a hydrant, hook to a hydrant? Blah, blah, blah. How to get a duck gun in it, And they're, like I said, they're called.
How about
and
at
first I
How
thought it was
it
a bunch of
BS,
John.
A two-person search team in there and conduct a primary search of a house.
Exactly. And I thought, like I said, I thought it was a bunch of who. When I first read it, and then I'm like, oh, God, this actually works. Now I've got something for our new guys to shoot for. Instead of very fast, I'm like, okay, what is very, because that, you know, that's like, how big's your wildland fire? Pretty big. It's a large fire. Well, large is kind of, it depends on who's describing large. What's large to you? Now, what's very quick to you may not be very quick to me. It may be slower. But when we've taken our department, our people, and put our people through a little timed event and gone, wow, we actually determine how quick that line should be stretched in. You know, you do your 360, you come back, you know, Lassie's got the line off stretch, flaked out charge, he's masked up. He's just waiting to snap on air. Here comes my captain. You know that in your head, like the roof stuff. You're inside, you're getting your ass kicked, and you go, hang on, Ricky. In about 30 seconds, you're going to hear that whole, you know, because I know where they're at. I know it takes them this long to throw that or get up there, cut a hole, instead of just very quick. So just what you said, John, that's perfect. And I, like I said, folks, I thought it was a bunch of, it takes some work, but man, the results are, you know, now you know how quick you can get things done and tell someone when they start. Here you go. So, all right. So stretching a line with first of our sequence events, you pull up, you got smoke showing. Can't get to the front door if you don't know how to stretch the hose and get there efficiently and everything else. So stretching that initial attack line. Number two, what do you think of number two? We said is ventilation, right?
Yeah.
Some form of ventilation.
We've had this discussion. Obviously, obviously, unique specific situations could occur, maybe a little bit differently. Very, very few things that arise at the scene of a fire should prevent the first hose line from getting stretched, right? So that's almost an absolute. But when we go to step two now, certainly ventilation is a great second choice. But if there's somebody at the front door screaming, there's two people in there, they're right down in the hallway, I crawl past them to get out here, we might have to make an adjustment there. We might have to send a crew in to make a quick grab, to make a quick search, pull some people out. Now, sending two firefighters to grab a portable ladder to help a woman out of the second floor window who's carrying a child, or to get in that front door, to go in 10 feet where there's reported people unconscious in the hallway, that's not necessarily considered a search. You know, that's not the same thing as getting a team of two or three firefighters geared up, ready to go, 2.5-gallon extinguisher, force plunger tools, SCBA, let's go, guys, get to the second floor and start a search for us. That's an organized tactical search. That's a little bit different than maybe sending a quick crew in or up a ladder real quick in the front of our side of the building to pull somebody out of a window who's in, you know, immediate danger, right? So back to the ventilation thing, back to getting somebody, you know, into a position to do some ventilation. That's a great second, you know, strategy, a great second activity to get underway.
Well, and we talked about this before. So you pull up with that first arriving engine. If you're lucky staffing-wise, you know, obviously you have someone driving, you have an officer and at least one firefighter in the back. If you have a four-person crew, someone's pumping, officer's doing 360, John's stretching the line, I can grab my tools. If it's, we're talking private dwellings, single-family dwellings, I can hook it to the back because we always talked about front door. Never say never, never say always, but should almost always, the front door should be the door of choice. I hoof to the back by me simply forcing the back door, giving you a second, you know, or taking one window, given. So if we're attacking the fire through the front and just taking one, you've seen that, one window, one door on the back side does so much to relieve the pressure, you know, of what's going on inside fire smoke-wise, you know, because some people say, well, I only have one extra firefighter. They show up in a car or one person, or that's all I have left. I'm like, why would you waste them? The outside vent, we talked about this, the OV, the outside vent person can make or break your whole incident. One person can make it easier or more difficult on that first in crew on that line.
And
go ahead.
And what lends itself very nicely to this concept in a volunteer fire service almost exclusively is the exterior firefighter, right? And I know there's some career people that, you know, shake their heads when I hear this being talked about. The bottom line is it's reality. Lots of volunteer fire departments have either older folks that have passed their prime and are not really putting the SCBA on going in anymore, but they're still active, they're still working, they're still going to calls, or maybe some young folks that haven't completed the whole training regimen yet, maybe aren't interior qualified yet, but they're still geared up, they still have basic training, they still respond to fire force. So you have these exterior firefighters that, if they're properly trained and know what they're doing, they can be dispatched to the side or the rear of a building, a house fire, let's say, where a line is going in the front door, and they can do some good outside ventilation work. I don't want to call them necessarily the outside vent guy, because an outside vent entails more than just venting. It calls for that firefighter to enter and search and do some other things too, which this firefighter may not be able to do. But exterior firefighters can get a lot of work done at a working fire in a volunteer fire company. And one of the major things they can do is some exterior ventilation.
Exactly. So we're stretching a line. We want to get water in a fire as quickly as we can to the scene of the fire to do what we're doing. We're in there. We get a line stretched. We're going to go probably quick attack. We know we always have somebody bringing water for us, a tender, a line, 5-inch, or we dropped on the way in, forward lay, or we did a reverse lay, whatever, all those situations you and I have talked about plenty of times. But sequence of events for a private dwelling, single family dwelling, we're stretching a line, boom, good 360 by the officer. Even if they just took a duck because they pulled up and they caught three sides, they know how deep the building goes. I don't know how you can crawl in and not have any clue whether it's one of these or it goes forever to just take a quick duck. Now I know how much I'm crawling or how far I'm pushing. You got that. So now ventilation wise, we either send someone to the roof, and this goes back, John, to our dispatching information. You're en route. Occupant call said house is on fire. Everybody's outside. They're out front. Now I know we still search, but it's different, like you said, than somebody saying, I'm outside. I can't get my husband and my two kids are still inside. My husband back and my two kids, they're still not. Now you know you got three people, adult and two kids in there, you know, and that sequence of events is going to change. Like you said, instead of throwing someone up on a roof, in goes the line, in goes the search crew, because you're being told right now they're in there. Versus, all right, I'm going to pull up, stretch a line, crew, I see him coming, put a hole in the roof, you guys do me a search, that kind of, you know. So stretching a line, ventilating, whether it's one person catching a window, a door to back of his house or to the roof, searching wise. Sequence of events, and I know this sounds kind of basic to some people, but we need to cover this, John. Your search crew is going in. You know, we talked about this plenty of times before. Where do you fire in a bedroom, you know, right corner of the house? I won't get into all the different, you know, Charlie Delta stuff, whatever you want to do. Fire on that side of the house. Where do you want your search team to start, John? Masked up, poor visibility or zero visibility? We're talking, we stretch the line. We got some kind of ventilation going on. Where do you want the search team to start for you? What are you expecting as a chief?
Right. The variables here are gigantic, because if you have a two-story house or a one-and-a-half-story house with bedrooms or something on the second floor, and you have a kitchen fire or a living room fire on the first floor, obviously our hose line is going to be stretched in a direction to the fire. Now, if there's people reported trapped at a particular location, obviously that's a priority. If there's reported kids trapped in the second floor bedrooms, obviously that's going to be a priority. However, sometimes the priority ends up on the fire floor, even if there's a floor above it. Even if there's a floor above, which is a severely, you know, threatened area, right, an exposed area, you get a fire in a kitchen or a dining room or even in a living room, there still could be people threatened. I mean, most homes I've been in still have bedrooms, maybe just one, but they still got a bedroom or two on the first floor. So that's something you really got to think long and hard about. The incident commander or whoever's dispatching or assigning the search crew, they really got to put some thought into that. That's something you got to train on a lot, and you got to listen to the radio, you got to listen to the dispatcher, you got to listen to people at the scene and decide where to send a crew in. I want to make another point before we get too far into the whole search thing, because there's a lot of search stuff to talk about. But a lot of places, I know a lot of chiefs, And a lot of other people that are, you know, incident commanders before the chief arrives, a lot of people want to stretch a backup line right away. They want to stretch a second hose line at a working fire. And I know it's important. And rarely did I have a working fire in the Bronx in the 18th battalion where I didn't get a second line, at least in front of the building, at least pulled off the rig for a working fire. If I stretched one, I stretched two. Most of the companies,
John,
I work with, 46
real,
engine
real,
and 88
quick.
Engine.
Real quick, and you said it perfectly. We talked about it. I just want to mention this. If folks you listen to John or I talk before about this, stop calling the second line always the backup line. John, you've talked about it. It's a second line that could be a backup line, an exposure line. It can fight fires on the second floor. When you say backup line, I know I'm getting hung up on a term, and I know what people think. I'm like, I just like the phrase second line, because then I'll tell you whether I want to back up, get to the second floor exposure. But keep going, buddy. Keep going.
Right. And the obvious benefit to saying, give me a second line is now it's open to be sent anywhere. Once you get to the front of the fire building, you say, hey, 46, you know what? Get to the floor above. I think they got some extension on the floor above. Okay, chief. And off they go. You know, when you call it a backup line, you tend to start to think that that's giving you an assignment, giving you to back up the first engine, which is to go where they are, which we may or may not you to do. I got to tell you, in 33 years in the FDNY, 17 years as a battalion chief in the Bronx, I can't remember too many times the first engine saying, get me some help in here. Get me another line to back me up in here. I can't remember it happening too many times. Most of the time, the second engine ends up being dispatched somewhere else, an adjacent area to where the first engine is working, or maybe the area above, much more commonly to the area above where the fire, you know, original fire room is. So that's something you want to think about as well. But my point was, the second line does not take priority over a search team, unless there's some specific reason where there's a truck or a crew on the floor above saying, hey, you know, ladder two to command, we got fire up here on the second floor above that kitchen fire. We got extension in the second floor bedroom. We need a line up here. Well, then, by golly, you better get. And I don't want to nail you down to the next engine, but you better get a line up there as quickly as possible. The fact of the matter is, I think the fire service in general around the country spends a lot more time, and we waste a lot more time sending a second line or stretching a second line sometimes where they're not even called for yet. And instead of sending a search team in. And what areas should be searched? Any area that is searchable, that can be entered to be searched. There's no definition of when we should be going in for a search. We should be going in for a search in any building that's on fire to search the searchable areas. I'm talking about house fires now. House fires and you know, private dwellings. Any area that can be searched should be searched. If there's no fire in a bedroom in the rear on the first floor, that room should be searched, as should maybe the whole second floor above a kitchen fire or something like that. So that concept sort of makes that decision easy. What areas get searched first or second is another discussion altogether.
Well, and for our incident commanders out there, and I think this is where we're going with this, John, you've always got the clipboard hanging here, the imaginary clipboard of your sequencing of events. My clipboard is water on the fire, you know, vent, search, writ, second line, all that. But like you said, there's a lot, and you hear a lot that, you know, when we do our classes, that's like they stretch a line and before anything else, they want a second line there instead of addressing these other things. So you've got this imaginary clipboard hanging there of all these boxes you got to check off. But there has to be, as we're talking sequencing events, some priorities said. One is, we can't emphasize enough, folks, water on the fire. As quickly as you can, all right? Searching the building, you know, and our boss, Chief David Rose, remember what he said at best? We were doing a show, John, the aggressive fire attack. And what'd he say? The only reason we go to fires, the only reason we respond to fires is to search. Everything we do supports searching. Attack of the fire, ventilation, everything is to search, searchable. You said it when you made me think of it. Searching searchable spaces. Go ahead.
And these priorities also depend heavily on your staffing. And a lot of now there's some volunteer fire departments that have pretty good staffing, pretty good, you know, daytime people are in the village, people work, people are in town, they're allowed to leave their jobs or whatever. Some career departments have light staffing. They got three people, a driver, an officer, and one firefighter in the crew compartment. You know what? You don't have the luxury of having all these people pouring out to the fire scene to say, okay, the next two will do a search. Well, the next two might be 4, 5, 6, 7, 10 minutes away. So you got to use those first 4, 6, even 8 firefighters. There are some places right now, there's guys right now listening and saying, 8 firefighters? It takes us 15 minutes to get 8 firefighters there. That's why those first 2 and 4 and 6, those first couple of pairs, those first couple of doubles, first two go in, stretch a line. Second two maybe should be a search team on a private dwelling fire at night. Get some people in there in the second floor bedroom. Make sure anybody up there who's waiting to be rescued or needs to be rescued has somebody coming for them. Then maybe the third pair, the third two available firefighters, maybe they'll stretch a second line, or maybe one of them will be the outside vent guy, and maybe the other one will be a guy that stretches the second line to the front door and waits for another available firefighter to stretch that second line in when available. So, you know, incident commanders, folks that are sending teams in to do the different jobs that have to be done at a house fire, have to remember that the staffing is not unlimited. Now, obviously, you get a place like New York City or Boston or Chicago that have, you know, adequate or good staffing, right? I don't want to call it more than enough because there's never enough, right? But compared to folks that have lighter staffing, if you have light staffing, you better select the assignments very carefully because you can't undo it, you know?
Well, and I guess, you know, one of the things you and I have talked about, again, I say this all the time, plenty of times. So we're calling this the first arriving sequence of events. You know, we use the phrase call an audible all the time when it comes to SOGs, is that I think sometimes people, and you and I talked about this in one of our classes years ago, I know in Illinois, we pigeonholed a lot of incident commanders, John, in the incident command, incident management class, where they were so busy drawing pictures and with their clipboard, you know, because that's their talk. Get their pass. I told you about the guy, we had three buildings going. We had one occupied, two unoccupied, you know, two vacant. And we right on the border, remember telling the story, right on the border, and it was on their side of the street. I got a full still coming in there. And I went up to him. He opens the back doors. I go, what do you need? I got a full still coming. He goes, I need their passports. They're coming. I went, okay, yes. What do you need? Do you want us to take the building to fire on the right? He goes, and he's drawing pictures. And I'm like, that's not what you should be doing right now. So for our listeners, when we say the sequence of events, you got to, and you said it, John, you got to have roller skates on in your head, if you will, because you may pull up thinking I'm going to do this and not be able to do that. Cars, blockage, people, nobody inside. Somebody ran back inside. Fires, not only it wasn't on the second floor, it's actually in the basement. So when we talk about first arrival sequence events, aside from getting water to the fire, you already said it. You know what? They're screaming or somebody's in there. Second thing we may do is search, and ventilation may have to wait a second, you know, or whatever. There's all these different things that are going to dictate our sequence of events, depending, aside from getting water on the fire, you know. So to our listeners, don't get hung up into the check boxes. It have to be 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. As much as you have to get those tasks done. Go ahead, buddy.
And here's a gigantic point, and I don't want to pull us off topic here, but I have to mention it because it affects exactly what we're talking about gigantically and negatively. And actually, it's a current topic that has just started to get some conversation and some attention lately, and that is the two in, two out. There's some folks lately, very recently, some people, some legitimate folks, and I count myself as one of them because I've been doing it for years. I've been calling two in, two out into question for years. I am not a fan, and I've never been a fan of two in, two out for firefighting operations. You know it yourself. You were involved in the development of two in, two out, you know, for hazmat operations and several other things. And it sort of got kicked over to, and firefighting sort of got dragged into it at the last minute and rolled into the two in, two out. And now we have firefighters and fire officers and chiefs who are complying with the law, who are paying attention to the rules and saying, hold on a second. No, we can't get that first team in there yet. I don't have the next team here yet. And really slowing down the whole thing and really making it, I believe, and I've said this in class, I've said it in podcasts, I've said it many times before, waiting for that two out, waiting to assemble and get that two out together, whether you're trying to figure out you're going to use the incident commander or not, or the pump operator and all this other nonsense, right? And I call it nonsense because different states actually have variations on the rules and do different things a little bit differently. It really does slow down the initial fire attack, and it absolutely, in a really big way, two in, two out, slows down the primary search. And I watch the numbers. I've been watching the numbers for years. Civilians that die in America in fires, most of them, by a gigantic percentage, are in their homes, okay? So that's what we're talking about here. And it's not 3,000 anymore. It's approaching 4,000. It's approaching the last couple of years, 4,000 civilians have died in fires in America in their homes, waiting to be rescued by firefighters that maybe never got there or didn't get there in time. So I think sometimes we hinder our own operation, and I think we endanger our community sometimes to a degree by standing on and mandating that two in, two out. And I think it's got to be reexamined. I think it's got to be looked at.
Well, and you both, you and I posted it with a ton of other people. There was recently a great article And you can, to our listeners, you can Google pull up or whatever just on that. And one of the things, not to get down that rabbit hole too far, is when 2 and 12 was first written, most places, the only person that had a portable radio was a company officer. You didn't have everybody with radios. You didn't have the type of protective clothing, the type of tracking software, the type of things we have now that allow us to do what we have to do. So it's something that needs to be looked at again as to whether he's to stay or be gone or whatever. But you're right. It's there's no argument. It's outdated, but it pigeonholes people because you hear them pull up and they go, we're out. We have a 2-story single family dwelling with heavy smoke show. We'll be waiting on engine number 12 for 2 and 12. And I want to scream going, really? You know, I'm just, you know.
It's like the first guys that pull up to a house fire, a nail and a board up across the front door. The first thing to do is put up a board across the front door so he can't go in. And it's just the opposite of what we need to do. We need to get it. We, you know, my favorite term, get your ass in there. You need to get a crew in there as soon as possible with a line and somebody right behind them looking to search. Yep.
Absolutely. Well, so we've been talking the first arriving sequence of events at single-family dwelling fires. And, folks, you can adjust this to commercial or high-rise or whatever, multifamily dwelling. But like John said, we don't like the words easy. It's more efficient to talk about the private dwellings and single-family dwellings because then you can apply it to whatever. But we talked about what you should be listening to when the call is dispatched. And I don't want to forget something. I wrote myself in my head a little note. You said it, John. Listening to the radio. Every firefighter, don't become tone deaf. Listen to what's going on your radio the whole time. Voices, how loud they are, what people are saying, progress reports. Listen to the radio. You said that before, John. I didn't want to go past that. So getting there, getting out the door, career or volunteer, as quickly and as safely as possible. Apparatus positioning when you pull up. Line selection. What do you have showing? What do you need? People, staffing, mutual aid, automatic aid. Stretching a line. The most important thing, folks, we can do is get water as quickly to the scene of the fire as possible. That doesn't happen if you don't train. If you don't train on stretching hose, you don't train on you flowing water, you don't change on getting geared up, all the things John and I talked about at the beginning here, you're going to be the one on YouTube that we're all looking at going, wow, look at how long it's taken to get a line in place. Secondly, the events, like John said, you know, that come after that are going to be dictated by what you actually have. That's why I always laugh when there are people, John, that say, this is how our department does it every time. I'm like, really? So you go to the same exact fire with the same exact challenges, the same exact everything every single time? No, nobody does that. So you've got to be able to call an audible. You have to be on roller skates, you know, to be able to make decisions and change and go, hey, guys, you know, check that, do this, do that. Everything from bad hydrants to people running back in after kids or dogs to everything to how much fire, the type of construction, what's burning, how much is burning, all these things dictate it. So whether it's search second or it's vent second or simultaneously, we talked about second lines. This was not a ritual, but you got to be thinking about getting somebody there ready to take care of your people. And I guess, John, let's end it with this. You say this all the time. The time to think about how to get extra help there shouldn't be when you're standing in front of the building. I've been listening to you say this since the early 90s. You need to have that stuff determined before you ever leave the firehouse, before they ring the bells. Automatic and mutual aid should be figured out ahead of time, not while you're standing there and people are hollering, things are going, go, give me an engine from Beeperville, get me this. A plan that gets stuff coming right away. So you turn around, they actually bump into you. Chief Salka, what do you need? Oh, hey, all right, Washingtonville, do me a favor. I need a line here. You know, instead of, well, I sure wish I had more people here. John, you got sequence of first arriving sequence events. Any additional things to finish things out here before we finish this show off? Any other suggestions or ideas?
That point you made is great because I know sometimes when my pager goes off for a report of a structure fire or smoke in a building or something, even other things, even MVAs and emergencies and things like that. I take off out of my house, heading for my vehicle out in the driveway, and I don't live in my fire district. I live in an adjacent district, not that far away, but in an adjacent district. And I go out the door, and what do I hear? I hear the siren going off from the local firehouse. Why? Because they're on automatic response to us, and I know they're coming too now. So what a great feeling that is, going to report a smoke in a house or a structure fire, and when I go out the door to respond to my firehouse to get on the first new rig, I hear the neighboring department siren going, and I know they're going to be coming too. So automatic response is wonderful. ISO handles that wonderfully too. You get a lot of credit for that in your ISO rating for automatic response. And you don't get credit for calling them on the radio. You don't get credit. You can be on the way there and say, transmit a second alarm and give me a company from here and a company from there. That may help you that day at the fire, but it's not. But it does nothing for your ISO rating, and it does nothing because it's a really delayed attempt to try and get help versus if they're simultaneously dispatched with you. Now you got two other rigs rolling up from two other departments with two or three guys on board. Boom, you got enough guys to do everything quickly, you know?
Well, and so let me just real quick, you made me think of something. Let's open up the Chief John Salka FTNY playbook. You look at Jack Schiavone or you look at Chris DeLizio, you get a 1075. I know what you're asking for. They're actually asking you, Chief 101, above and beyond what you already have coming there, what's coming on a 1075 versus this versus that. You are notorious in a great way for always ordering up an exit engine and a truck, regardless. And it ended up being a mattress. It doesn't matter to John Salka, the battalion. You've always got, and that's what I've played off of. I've had second alarm standing behind me in the street going, hang on, I think they got this. Hang on a second. Versus, okay, man, I better call for help. But you've always done, give me an initial engine and a truck for pretty much anything that started out could be relatively minor or before it went somewhere where other guys are going, boy, I don't want to look like I overreacted. If John Salka could do that and not worry about pride and people saying things, because it's about your people first and then those people out there, you can't keep your people safe unless you bring enough people to scene, and you can't do what you're supposed to do for them unless you bring enough people to scene, and you can't do that by waiting.
And I was fortunate because it was already established in the FDNY. Give me an additional engine and truck. That was a standard. That was an SOP for lots of people for decades, you know, through the war years and the waning years after that, where it didn't get, you know, a little bit less fire duty, maybe, even though there's still plenty. My point is, I was fortunate. I stepped into a job where that was already an acceptable term. Give me an additional engine and truck. It was an acceptable process, right? You may be in a fire department where that's not. But maybe you're the new guy. Maybe you're the new captain or the new battalion chief or the new chief of the fire department. Maybe you can be the guy to start a new process like that or a new tradition like that where you can add that to your SOPs and say, you know what, don't ever be afraid. You don't have to call a second alarm, but if it looks like you got something and you think you might need more help, you could just say that to the dispatcher. Give me an additional engine and truck. And right off the bat, they can give you the first two units that would be on a second alarm if you called it. Some folks don't call a second alarm because they're a little hesitant because they're looking at this house fire saying, this might just be a room. We might have this in a minute. If I call a second alarm, I got three more departments coming. I got the staff chiefs all coming in from headquarters. It may all be unnecessary. And, you know, and I'm not justifying the way they feel because I think they're wrong. I think you should always call for more help if you need it, regardless of how it ends up ending, you know, panning out. But if you give them an option, if you give them an option in between a second alarm, calling another whole alarm, give them, you know what? Give me additional engine and truck. And the dispatcher knows, boop, boop, there's the next two. And he sends them in. Now you got a little more help on the way. They get there. You can hold them right there at the command post. And now you feel a little level of comfort because you know you got a fresh engine and a fresh truck to be quickly deployed somewhere if you need them. And you don't have to maybe go for another whole alarm. You can still call it if you want, but you can get that additional engine and truck on the way. Great. It's a great habit. I'm glad the FDNY had that in place when I you know, went up through the ranks. I'm glad it was already an acceptable process.
Well, what we say, call often and call early. You could always send them home. And if you don't want to go to a fire, then get out of the fire service. You know, who doesn't want to go to a job? So, all right, buddy. If they want to get a hold of you, what's the best email?
ChiefJohnSalka@gmail.com.
And I'm Chief Lasky at gmail.com. You can catch a ton of great podcasts right here at fireengineering.com. You can also go through the archives, pull them up. You go right to our show, The Command Post, and listen to all of them. We've been doing them for years and years and years and years. Same thing with the Hump Day Hangouts. Other than that, catch us, like I said, every third Wednesday. You'll catch us every third Thursday for this show with Fire Engineering. That's our regular slot. Share them. Shoot us some ideas if you have any. We hope you and your family's doing well. Give us a shout if you need anything. John and I always, with all of our shows, end it with one very important phrase, and that's in closing, please keep the men and women in armed forces in your thoughts and prayers. And remember this, never forgetting, means never forgetting. Be safe. God bless you. And thanks for joining us.
Take care.
Everybody up on this roof, they're all off the roof. I am on the roof of exposure 4. Got fire through the roof of the fire building in the entire rear section.
Now remember, given the payday, as you can account it for, okay?
610B, that was the payday, 610B.
I'm here. We got a fire. 1.5-story, single-family dwelling. Fire shown from the second floor. Give me a second alarm on this.
Stay up to the top floor. I got people hanging out the top floor windows with a baby.
Commercial building. A lot of fire, a lot of smoke. Go ahead and strike a third alarm on my orders on this.
I got people on the front fire escape here with windows vented below them. We need somebody up there.
Yeah, let them know we got a job. I'm pulling up now. Second alarm, I got a 1-story single family frame. Heavy fire showing from the attic.
How we're using all here is we got one line stretch, fire on the fourth floor, second line being stretched. Primary stretches are underway.
Like a trusted turnout jacket you've had for years, Flex 7 outer shell fabric delivers a perfectly broken in feel on the very first wear. Flexible, comfortable, and powered with the strength of Enforce technology, Flex 7 Outer Shell Fabric is made to move. To learn more, visit TenkataFabrics.com/Flex7. Flex 7, powered by Enforce technology, only from Tenkata Protective Fabrics.
Breathing in diesel exhaust fumes is like walking into a fire without a mask. Over time, those toxins lead to cancer. Protect yourself with MagnaGrip, the easiest, most reliable exhaust removal system that features a true 100% seal to eliminate diesel exhaust fumes. To get free grant assistance, visit MagnaGrip.com.